Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. Economy is buzzing along, humming along. America is the only superpower in the world. World domination. Great golden era of the post-World War II Americana. Pax Americana. And you're going to take all the credit in history for elevating the United States to its apex, at least in the 50 years in which you lived. And then you commit the most frivolous, stupid, high schoolish prank, and you're forever affiliated with some scandal that haunts you till the day you die and will shame you in the annals of U.S. history. So I remember someone once said, if you could ask Bill Clinton one question, what would you ask him? I know what my question would be. Four words. What were you thinking? Sometimes people act out of such folly that in retrospect, as if, what were you thinking? What was your, as we would say in the base matters, what was your havamina? You're in the White House. She's a presidential intern. It's not as if there aren't cameras or people or word isn't going to leak out. What were you thinking? Well, Chazal asked that same question, but not of Bill Clinton, but of Korach. But it's a question that's just as pertinent to Korach as it is to Bill Clinton. This is Moshe Rabbeinu. It's one thing for Avshalom to challenge David HaMelech. It's one thing for Yaakov and Esav to have tension. It's Moshe Rabbeinu. On the heels of him, second rescue of the Jewish people. It's not clear chronologically when the Meraglim occurred, but it happens after the Cheregel. His dedication to the Jewish people is unquestionable. His ability to intercede on behalf, to defend them. His ability to scale the mountains and spend 40 days without food or water. Lechem lo chalti, mayim lo shatiti. The miracles, the makos, the yamsuf. If there's one person whose leadership should be absolutely obvious and unquestioned, it's Moshe Rabbeinu. And here's Korach rustling up 250 rebels to try to challenge Moshe's authority. Like, what did you think? Of course Hashem's going to create an earthquake. And so this is Chazal's question. Ma ra Korach, source number 5, part Aleph. Korach shepikei achaya. Korach's a prince. Korach's educated. He isn't a fool. He isn't an imbecile. He's not hallucinating. Although he is, as we'll see in a moment. What is he thinking? Ma ra l'shtus hazeh. How does he delude himself into such? It takes a lot. The greater the folly, the greater the seduction and the delusion. How does a person reach such folly, such error? Is it greed? Is it lust? Is it jealousy? Those are very powerful forces. But at some point, the larger the mistake, the easier it is to avoid. And even these powerful urges and forces and even hormones can't convince us of something which is so impractical and asinine as to try to challenge Moshe Rabbeinu. What possible idea can drive this flight of fancy that ends in disaster? How can you challenge Moshe Rabbeinu? So Chazal have a very powerful answer. And it's the most dangerous trait. And it's a trait that's dangerous for two reasons. One is because you need a lot of it to succeed in life. And two is when you feel it, it feels noble and holy and ideal. So it's hard to see when it starts to become ugly and vile and abusive and exploitative. And sometimes when you're wrestling with the discernibly dangerous traits, you know you feel greedy. Sometimes you're able to overcome it, sometimes you're not, but you know you're being overcome by an unhealthy, toxic trait. You feel a lust, you know you shouldn't feel it. Sometimes you're able to control it, sometimes you're not. But there's a trait that you don't even know that you're struggling with because you feel like it's fueling so much that's noble and good. It's this elastic trait that melds itself or molds itself to your noblest and purest thoughts and ideals. And you think you're acting on behalf of ideals and you're really acting on behalf of this trait that's just hypnotizing you into a stupor. And that's called the trait of ambition. Because Korach has a lot of ambition and he's fooled by his ambition. because he has a vision that one day there'll be great leaders that will stem from his progeny. Source number 5. Eino hita'aso, his vision fooled him. Ra shalshelas gedola omedes himena. He saw this great leadership. Shmuel was a descendant of Korach. Shmuel Hanavi, Shmuel who is essentially a parak monarch, a parak king. So he says, if I'm going to produce a Shmuel, then I must also be slated for glory. I must also have some special contribution to make. I have something special about me. And I guess he felt a little bit invulnerable because God can't take me out of the picture because Shmuel has to descend from me. He didn't realize that maybe Korach would die, but his children would survive, as Chazal tells on the way down. Right before Gehenna, they were breathing the vapors of Gehenna. They're breathing the fires of Gehenna. They couldn't even open their mouths, because if they would open their mouths to sing Shira, the fires would have incinerated them. So they just thought, Lam Natzeach Lamei Korach Mizmar. They thought a few Parakim in Tehillim, and that was their Tshuva, and Hashem lifted them from Gehenna. Which is a very powerful statement about Tshuva. Maybe we'll talk about it in Mitzvah and Elul again. People think it's too late for Tshuva, and it has to be complete Tshuva. It's sincerity. And sincerity doesn't need a voice, and sincerity doesn't need a poem, and sincerity doesn't need a protracted experience. It's just really looking at yourself honestly and feeling remorse and trying to change. And Korach is a monster of ambition. And he's crazed. And there's nothing. There's no sanity. There's no reason. There's no proportion. He feels like I have a special talent. And that's what ambition does to people. And the danger is you really need to be ambitious to accomplish in life. Because if you're not ambitious, you don't have a sense of worth and ego and belief in yourself and ability to contribute. But there's so many dangers that ambition poses. Of course, the greatest danger is not just the fallacy of delusion. It's also the great whisper in your ear that the ends justify the means, which it never, ever does. Rarely does. It's because you feel like the ends are so great. And the ambition that you're serving, the larger purpose of you're saving the free world, you're leading the Jewish people to the world of tomorrow, you're rescuing people's Torah, you're helping them become more religious. These are all noble, and these are all bold and elevated ideals. Sometimes the easiest climb to the top is on the backs of other people. And you cross all sorts of moral red lines, and you crash all sorts of areas you're not invited to, metaphorically, because you're serving some larger purpose, because this is noble and ideal and higher value and higher ground. Be very careful in your life, because hopefully you'll be very ambitious, you'll be very accomplished, you'll be very driven. Check yourself often. Check yourself on this yardstick or this metric. Are you pursuing certain ambitions, which I think are legitimate, but what means are you taking to pursue those ambitions, and are those means appropriate? Is your ambition blinding you to certain realities that are staring you in the face that should be obvious and that people are whispering to you and should be clear that Moshe Rabbeinu was unassailable, but you just don't listen because you're intoxicated with ambition? Are you looking to be ambitious and you are neglecting ambitions that are more naturally yours? Because that's really what Korach is guilty of. He's a Levi. He has avoda. It's not like he's sitting home watching the baseball game. He's a Levi. He has responsibility. He has duties. It's not necessarily the duties of Moshe Rabbeinu. Hashem allocates different responsibilities and missions. So very often, we get involved in competition for competition's sake, ambition for ambition's sake. Remember, I quoted Bill Clinton in the 90s. In the early 2000s, there was a terrible corruption, a financial scandal in Houston. In the 90s, Houston was fueled by an energy boom. And several corporate executives were caught basically grafting money from their corporations into lining their own pockets. It was called the Enron scandal. So someone interviewed one of the Enron executives who was jailed for 30, 40 years after the scandal, after he was indicted. He asked him, I don't understand something. You are making so much money, legally. You are making enough money to afford whatever you would need for your life, for your children's life, and for your grandchildren's life, many grandchildren as you'd have. You had absolutely no financial pressure. At what point didn't you realize that this was foolish? To imperil your freedom just because you needed the next $20 million, which you didn't need. And he looked at the interviewer and said, you just don't understand. It had nothing to do with whether I had what I needed. It just was a question of out-competing other people who was earning more money. And it was such a portrait of tragedy, such a tragic image of greed that had no purpose. It was just one-upsmanship. And that greed landed these people, and everything they had acquired was worthless and pointless to them now because they're spending the next 40 years in jail. So it's the same thing with ambition. Moshe says, Hamat mikem, ki yivdil Hashem l'keyes cham. Hashem already gave you a mission that fits you. I've got mine, you've got yours, and you can't settle into your mission because you're always restless for that next thing that brings you fame and brings you attention and comes the fever of your soul. And Korach is such an interesting, to a degree, Yosef is also that portrait. I don't think I was here for Parshas Vayeshev, I think it was in the States, but Yosef has these dreams, and reality doesn't seem to accommodate those dreams, because his dreams are that he'll be the ruler and his children and his brothers will bow to him, and it doesn't seem to be happening. Even when he's appointed the ruler of Egypt, there's no fast lane by which his brothers are going to come and bow down to him. They're in Israel, he's in Egypt. But all of a sudden he seizes his opportunity, he seizes it and senses it and starts to orchestrate a very manipulative series of events just to implement those dreams. And to his credit, he caves. When it gets to the point that he's really trampling on human emotions and they fear for their lives, Vayisapak and Lo Yechol Yosef L'sapek, and in Parshas V'Yigash, the great reveal. And he's open and he's candid with his brothers and Yosef Achicha. So there's so many dangers that ambition brings, and Korach is just such a portrait of folly, of idiocy, of lunacy, because he deludes himself into believing that since he's going to contribute, you may contribute, may not contribute. And that becomes his own trap. It's a beautiful novel written by Henry James. Henry James was an English author. The novel is called Beast in the Jungle. It's a small novel. Can you close the door, please? The novel is called The Beast in the Jungle, about a young man who has a premonition that he'll contribute something really great to this world. He has that premonition at a very early age. And then every decision he makes is handicapped by trying to orient that decision based on whether it can enable that opportunity, that potential. So when he wants to fall in love with a woman, he's hamstrung because, is she the woman that will help me achieve that endpoint? And when he wants to take a job, how does his job factor in? So basically, he's hamstrung because of the premonition. And that's what makes the metaphor so powerful, the beast in the jungle. There's this beast that's just lying in the jungle, and just the knowledge of that beast frightens him and incapacitates him. And sometimes our ambition is that beast in the jungle, where we are so driven and aspirational that instead of reacting to life, we try to re-landscape it based on our ambition. Instead of seeing reality, we concoct alternate realities. We conduct our own narratives to accord with our own ambitions. And it's very hard to convince people that there's something off, there's something wrong. Why do you think there's so many politics in Jewish institutions or in any idealistic setting? Because if you're working for Microsoft and you think the butterfly should be blue and your coworker thinks the butterfly or the window should be yellow, so you'll take it to your supervisor and he'll make a decision. And if you were outvoted, it's not the end of the world as far as you're concerned. It's just a logo. It's just a color. It's just a pixel. But when you're working for the sake of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for Torah, for the Jewish community, for the state of Israel, for fill in the blanks, I mean, any ideal, you're deeply invested. You're deeply impassioned by it because you feel like you're serving something larger. But level-headed people and emotionally balanced people, it's in okay. Well, how do you discriminate between you and the larger need? Because sometimes it gets so wrapped up with one another. And you're unable to see how much of it is me and how much of it is really selfless serving of some larger purpose. And that's where Korach fails. Vayikach Korach. I said this a little bit in this morning's Chassidus. It's about Korach. Vayikach Korach. Korach is front and center. There's no selflessness. There's no submission. There's no stepping aside. It's just Korach sees red. And he's driven by that, and he's ratified in his mind by that because he sees this great, great opportunity that he feels he's going to contribute to society. So that's a mistake Korach makes. But how does he dupe 250 people? Where is that mistake? It's one thing to make your own mistake. How do you convince 250 people of this ridiculous, ridiculous scenario? The answer is, he's the best demagogue I've ever met. Actually, the second best demagogue. I met a good demagogue, not a good, but a very effective demagogue. But let me describe demagoguery for you. Not because I think anyone here will become a demagogue, but because the last exit before demagoguery is something that a lot of you may fall into. So demagoguery is not an all or nothing proposition. There is something that leads to it that you have to be careful about. So let's first read how Korach spins his tail and spellbinds his cast or his audience. Okay? He gathers everyone in front of Moshe's hotel, in front of Moshe's tent. Now you all know, because you're learning Menachos, of the primary challenge. And he's trying to, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. If you have a house with many, many Sifrei Torah in it, do you need a mezuzah? If you have a baguette completely composed of tchelas, do you need a string of tchelas? What was he trying to convey by that? Well, I talked about that from the perspective of talis and the perspective of tefillin, but or bayis, mezuzah. In order to understand his end game with the talis and the bayis, let's first see the other story he tells to try to rankle Moshe and subvert people's respect and authority of him, or his authority. Take a look at source number one. But let me prepare everyone. I don't see you didn't really come prepared to this year. You may have to leave in the middle of this story because it may be such a tearjerker that you just won't be able to hold out. So just everyone be careful, and you don't have to ask permission. If you start crying uncontrollably, it's all right. You can leave. Okay, you have my permission. Get ready for a tearjerker. He gathers everyone. He starts wailing outside of Moshe's house. Hischel Omar Lehem, source number one. Divrei Leitzanos. Korach is called a letz. Now we think that letz means a joker. We'll see what letz really means. V'moshev leitzim lo yashev zekarach. What does it mean he's a letz? Amar Lehen, line 3. He says, let me tell you the story about Almana Achas Haisa B'shchunasi. There was a widow living in my neighborhood. Okay, right off the bat, everyone's really sympathetic. This is source Bays, part 1. So everyone already is sympathetic because we're talking about a widow who lost her husband. V'ima shtei naros yisamos. And there are two orphans that she's living with, Molly and Polly and Holly. And the two girls are just are starving. Line number 4, source Bays 1. V'hayla sadacha. She only has one lone field. Bas lachrosh. And she dutifully and responsibly wants to plow, plant some crops, and support her two little daughters. Who shows up? Moshe Rabbeinu. Sinister Moshe. Evil music in the background. On cue. Of course, Moshe is played with some actor wearing some handlebar mustache. I'm sure Korach probably put on some show. Moshe, with some mean-spirited, long sideburns, handlebar mustache, walks in and says, Lady! Lo tacharosh b'shor v'chamor yachdav. Don't you dare plow with your donkey and your ox. Stop it! So you clearly have Moshe restricting this poor lady who's trying to earn an honest living with his laws, with his rules, with his restrictions. Okay, she's pretty submissive. She says, you know what? Okay. Next line. Bas Lizra. She starts planting. Moshe shows up the next day. Now he's got a couple of his executioners, a couple of his guards, a couple of his bouncers with him, ready to tune her up a little bit. He says, don't you dare plant seeds and grapes together. So every time this person, this poor woman who has to support two daughters, just wants to earn an honest living, every 2 minutes Moshe's coming with some new restriction, some new limitation. Bas Lixar. So she follows Moshe's rules. She's now harvesting. And Moshe says, don't forget like a Chechopea. She wants to make a silo, put all of her grain together. Truma, Maiser, Rishon, Ani. She says, you know what? This isn't getting anywhere. It's too complicated. Earn an honest living. Moshe's there to thwart me. I'm just going to toss in the towel, sell my field, and I'll buy an animal. I'll earn my living, a little less. Fields produce more than animals. But at least I'll escape Moshe's tentacles. So she buys an animal, 2 sheep, and she wants to make some woolen garments for her children in the freezing winter. And she wants to get them milk to drink in the morning. I'm her lamb, Moshe says, end of the line, line number 7, line number 8, Tenuli Sebacharis. I get the firstborn. Give him over. Fork him over, woman. She says, you know what? Take the animals. Let my children starve. Hikiyazman Gziza. She now wants to share the wool and clothe her children. Moshe says, okay, Reishis Hagez. You got to give me 10%. You got to cut me in. Reishis Hagez at the beginning. She says, you know what? I can't take this anymore. I'm trying to earn some money. I'm trying to raise some flock. I couldn't plant. I can't raise my herd. You know what? I'll just sell them. Have one last meal. And maybe I'll starve, but at least I have a good meal. Hareini shachta son ve'ach l'san. Kivin she shachta. Now she
Shachs Amrla. Now Moshe shows up. I'm a Levi. Kohen. Tanila Zroa. L'chayayim. V'keva. Give me the arm. The leg of the animal. Give me the keva. Give me some pieces of this animal. She says, oh, I can't take this anymore. At least let me dedicate it to charity. At least I get a tax break. Amrla, she says, Harei alei cherim. I make it cherim so no one can touch it. Amrla, so Moshe says, get ready. This is the final scene. Moshe, carrying his pitchfork with a long tail and long tooth, says, ha, now it's all mine. All mine. You made it cherim. It's all hektish. I get it all. By this time, the crowd is in a restless, restless fury. Moshe Rabbeinu was the abuser of poor women and their orphans. We have to unseat him. We have to replace him. This is not the type of society we want to inhabit. Guys, that's called demagoguery. That's really what halacha is, to abuse women, to exploit orphans and amanos. All these halachos are carefully calibrated halachos to support an honor guard of Kohanim and Levim, who don't earn a living, who subject themselves to abject poverty for their whole lives. They're not getting rich. They're not being abusive. They're not taking specifically from orphans and from widows. Now, it just so happens that there could be certain situations in which there's a collusion of circumstances and this poor woman may be disadvantaged by all these responsibilities. And of course, in that case, the Kohen won't take from her. We'll give it back to her, or we'll sell it to her, or Beis Din will step in. But all of a sudden, he's finding the loophole, the weak point. That's what a demagogue was. That's what a demagogue does. He says, well, in this scenario, they all collude to be manipulative of some poor widow and deprive her and her children of any food. And that means the whole system is a farce. That means that this whole system of halacha is ridiculous and it's just abusive. Guys, that's demagoguery. That's where you take the one flaw and you explode it and you make everything seem like it's all flawed and it's all defective because you found the one limitation or the one strange circumstance. And that's how Korach, of course, is mocking Moshe with the tzitzis and with the bais and mezuzah. Yeah, of course it seems a little bit odd that if you have a house full of Sifrei Torah to put a mezuzah on the doorpost. But most houses are not full of Sifrei Torah. And halacha is standardized. And mezuzah is meant to create a symbolic set of commandments on the doorpost. And as I told you in the shiur, there's something unique about the doorpost that's symbolic. So you're right, in this one scene, it seems a little bizarre. But the system makes sense. And the one scene doesn't reflect the fallacy of the system. And the same thing with a beged. Most people won't afford a beged kol tchelis. Hashem wants us to have a sign of royalty and monarchy on our strings. And even if we do have a beged of tchelis, there's a structural difference between the beged and the strings, and the symbolism of the strings, and the symbolism of the beged. But he's riling them up by trying to mock the system by highlighting the flaw in the system by that one situation that renders it laughable or bizarre. That's what a demagogue does. A demagogue shades the truth by taking one truth and blowing it out of proportion and casting aspersions on the larger system for the sake of his demagoguery. And Korach is fantastic about it. Korach is the absolute, absolute. I mean, I don't want to say because I don't want to speak ill of the dead. The person I met was a demagogue, is no longer living with us, but not someone from here, but someone famous. And I saw this in action. Now, none of you are going to be demagogues, I hope. But demagoguery is based on the same condition as sarcasm or cynicism. It's one step further. Bright people are more prone to be cynical than less analytical people. Because they're always able to find the flaw in something, in a person, in an idea, in a school, in an institution, in a movement. And they latch onto that flaw or limitation or defect or whatever. And that becomes the linchpin through which they reject the entire system or person or idea. People of lesser analytical interests or inclinations, they see something favorable or good, or you say, wow, that's fantastic, that's great. They're awed by it. They're taken by it. They're enchanted. There's a sense of rapture and excitement. But when you're trained to analyze, as you are, well, everything has two sides to it. And if you work hard enough, you can always find the flaw in any system. Because nothing is perfect. Nothing of human convention is perfect. No body, no person, no life, no institution, nothing. But then you blow that out of proportion, and then you can be someone who rejects and is cynical. And just speaking to one of the boys yesterday, today, on his exit conversation, I was telling him about the balance between critical thinking and embracing things of value. And remember that when I raised my children, it's very important for me in the beginning of their development to ignore critical thinking on behalf of enchantment and enthusiasm. So, for example, they would come home often from school with ideas that their teachers had expressed, very often ideas which I didn't agree with. And there was a certain part of me that said, let me just go through them and step it through with them and say, well, this is, do you agree with this? Do you not agree with this? But then, basically, I'm diminishing their admiration for their teacher. And then tomorrow they're going to be less excited by that teacher. So I'm going to create children who are very, very adroit at critical thinking, but not very embracing of values delivered to them. And I've seen a lot of this, having dealt with a lot of boys and girls over the years. And, you know, I was not part of anyone's family, but sometimes I see it. So when I'm saying that person just had too much critical thinking, too many conversations at the table about whether this is right or wrong, and not enough conversation at the table, wow, that person is fantastic. That school did a wonderful job. That rabbi gave a great speech. Rather than saying, well, what did you like about the speech? What did you not like about the speech? And sometimes we're a little bit prone to that, where we try to dissect everything. And sometimes people, especially in this world, where we're trained not to see the Gemara in a unidimensional fashion. This is the answer. This is not the answer. This is the truth. What are the strengths of the Rishba? What are the strengths of the Rashba? What are the strengths of this? I'm able also to take a few steps back and say, okay, I can nitpick something into oblivion by endless critical analysis, but then there's a larger sense that this is Moshe Rabbeinu, this is halacha. There will be problems, and we will adjust for the problems and round out the situation and give this woman stucco, or the Kohen will be a little bit kinder to her and share the Zerah L'Chayim B'Keva, ask her to come join him for a meal or something. But this doesn't mean the system is flawed or the system is corrupt. That's why Korach is called Aletz. Again, read the beginning of Source Bay's Part 1. The first pasuk in Tehillim, Ashrei Ish Asher Lo Halach Batzas Rishtayim Uvederech Adam Lo Amad V'Moshev Leitzim Lo Yashav. Aletz is someone that's cynical. Korach was cynical plus. He was cynical and he was a demagogue. He was able to rile people into rejection of these great systems. I mean, halacha is the first moral system that supports a civilization. It takes people out of the world of savagery and of cannibalism and out of murder and hostility. It creates a stable, just world of order and government and charity and religious mindedness and value-driven experience. And this is a world that tried to protect people and advance their welfare, not abuse people. Again, there'll be a situation in which a person falls on hard luck and our society will step in. But you can't put on these dark-colored glasses through which everything seems dark and gloomy and depressing, and some people just wear those glasses. And I think some people, I'm responding to some things that were said at my barbecue with the people in my share, something I think people have to work very hard on, especially people that are bright. I saw an article in the New York Times about 5-6 years ago. They were able to trace sarcasm or cynicism to a certain location in the brain. What part of the brain is responsible for sarcasm and cynicism? And they found that that part of the brain was overdeveloped in intelligent people, which I think makes sense, because the first step of cynicism and sarcasm is analysis. And when you're intelligent enough, you can analyze, and then you've got the fodder or the material to be cynical. For some, that's less of an opportunity and hence less of a seduction or less of a challenge to them. I've got this very, very deep, almost visceral hatred for comedians because of that, because they're very smart people with a sharp eye of the world. And in some cases, not in all cases, but in many cases, it ends up being humor at the cost of another human being. I just don't think that that's healthy. I mean, here or there, let's say, the other night in yeshiva, we're all together, we're all one family, we're poking fun at each other in a loving way. But very often, it's just very, very demeaning and very aggressive. And I'm sure, again, there are comedians I enjoy listening to who are not that way, who make fun of themselves or make fun of things like in a way that's just not scathing and not abrasive. When you have these people that just, maybe I'm dating myself, but I feel like in the twos, the entire Torah world fell in love with Seinfeld. And all these yeshiva bachur watched every single episode. And because it was clean, because it was funny, Yeah, some of the values there are very dangerous. Indolence, not working at all, getting with as little work as possible, laziness, exploiting people, manipulating them, lying to... I'd rather you watch a movie or a television program with really deep, correct values, if they exist. Very often they don't, but closer to them, and know which scenes to avoid. And know there's going to be a scene, and 90% of the time you can know which scene. You know, you see certain scenes, you close your eyes to that point, or hear certain words that go in your head and out of your head. But at least the foundation of the program are values that are very, very correct and pure and noble. And rather than celebrating programs to a degree, again, I watch more of Seinfeld than I watch The Simpsons, I think, was also a program like that that just was very disrespectful, making fun of people's bodies and body odor and just, it wasn't supportive, it wasn't embracing, it wasn't, and I think that we have to be careful about that. Be a believing person. Be a supporting person. Find the good in people. They seem like adages and simple cliches, but you'd be surprised how foundational they are, and you can get caught in this whole whirlpool of overanalysis, which every single person can be reduced to subjective variables of good and evil because everything can be seen from different angles. And it's really, really harmful. And of course, as I warned you in the beginning of the year, but some of the boys warned you in the beginning of the year, the greatest casualty of cynicism is yourself. Because at a certain point, you stop believing in anything. Because everything has its flaw, and everything is terrible, and everything is failure, and everything is... So then you start to reject your world around you, and then you tighten the noose, and you start to reject people closer to you, your family, your friends, your spouse. At a certain point, it seeps in. It's toxic, you know. Here, Adam, is a good quote. We summon demons into this world, and we can't avoid their ultimate punishment. You know, we suffer from the demons that we invoke into this world. And when you invoke bitterness into your world, it ultimately circles back on you. And if you're not able to be favorable to other people, you're not able to be favorable to yourself. And at a certain point, you become that bitter old man that you've all met, who can't say a nice thing about the world, and everyone's out to get him, and the world is all a failure, and it's all a world of hostile enemies and hostile forces. It's not the way to lead your life. Okay, so two, I don't want to maybe end a little early. I'll speak about something else in a few minutes, but these are two good issues to think about, Korach, for your life. One is how you handle ambition. When I say handle ambition, I mean don't suppress it, but do you check yourself and say, am I serving ambition that's right for me, that's suited for me, that's natural, that Hashem wants me? It's hard to know, but is it something that, or do you have to assert yourself in ways that are unhealthy? Move people out of your way so that you can serve your ambition. Hurt people's feelings. Ignore people's feelings sometimes. Right? How many people suffer because of the ambitious agendas of others? How many children in this world don't have parents who pay attention to them because their parents are just chasing ambitions and programs that offer them promises of fame and accomplishment? Comes at the cost of the people that are just naturally waiting for you to say a nice word to them and spend time with them, pay attention to them. That's also a way to check yourself. In general, I would say, are the people in your world enhanced by your ambition, or the people in your world suffer because of your ambition? That's really a good test, and maybe you'll understand this one day when you grow older. Right? Is your ambition an explosion, and the people around you live in the debris of that explosion? Or your ambition is an elevator that takes people to different places because you help them become better and enjoy life and you better. It's a really good yardstick to see whether your ambition is being served in a healthy way or it's being served in an egocentric way. People have to live with the fallout of these volcanic, ambitious eruptions of ambitions, and they have to live in this volcanic, scorched earth. The second part is not demagoguery. Again, be on guard for demagogues. I mean, Trump is a fantastic demagogue. We'll take an idea and we'll just blow it out of proportion. It'll lead people down that road. And there's no facts and issues don't make a difference. I mean, again, it's even the biggest Trump supporter shouldn't believe that he's a wonderful person with good values. Those who support him feel that the policies can be divorced from the values of the person. But he's a fantastic demagogue. And even if he knows he's being such a good demagogue, but he's really artful in it. But it's not so much demagoguery as much as it is cynicism and to a degree sarcasm. And the first step towards it is this judgment, and you can always find someone to make fun of or something about that person to make fun of and lampoon and invert the entire system because of the flaw, rather than accepting the fact that every system and every arrangement and situation has a flaw, but it doesn't make it flawed. It just makes it real, natural. So you had a question before? Okay. Maybe let's talk about one issue which I think also is very, very meta, very core issue, and it comes up in Parshas Korach. And I think it's something which a lot of people wrestle with legitimately in a world of equality, in a world of Baruch Hashem democracy. Because to a degree, that's what's on tap between Korach and Moshe. Korach's basically pushing democracy. There's no reason you should be different. We're also talented, and we're equal before the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And in that equality, there's no allocation or apportioning of jobs that's fixed and that's unassailable, and therefore everything's up for grabs. And to a degree, that's the world you live in. And in that world, the notion of selection and the notion of mission is very caustic for some people. I've spoken to a lot of people who struggle with their religious values, and in many, many cases, this is the fulcrum of their struggle. Because the notion of a chosen people and a selected people in today's discourse sounds very bigoted and very racist. And what do you mean? I'm sitting in college, and I'm sitting next to my Asian laboratory partner, and our DNA is 99% identical. And he or she is an intelligent person with a lot to add to this world, and here I am walking around as if I'm chosen. It's wrong and it's bigoted. It's wrong factually and it's bigoted morally. How do I live feeling like a bigot? And at a certain point, the inability to reconcile that essentially sinks the entire enterprise of religion. That's what's really being discussed between Korach and Moshe. And Korach's point is very resonant to many people. And Hashem's response is as follows. And the response of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is encoded in one word. It's a very strange word in Parshas Korach. I talked about it this morning. There are many, many, many interpretations of it, but it's a very iconic word. Moshe tells Korach, wait a little bit, tomorrow Hashem will make his position clear. And what should Moshe tell Korach? Machar, which is what Aaron tells the people in the Egel. It's got Shulachem, Machar. And to the great delaying and letting calmer nerves prevail, letting people get a little perspective. It's always good to push things off when you feel that people are acting irrationally and think about it, go to sleep on it, sleep a little bit on it. Very often when I've spoken with you, I've said, you know what, sleep about it, take a few days, think about it, get back to me. Get a little perspective. Don't be hasty. Don't be impetuous in decision making. Think about things. Think things through. Very often, now that you're understanding how to learn a sugya, the best way to learn a sugya when you need a bump in the road is to take a break, go learn something else, clear your mind, and then see it from a different angle. Whenever you go in and out, you're able to get different perspective. Remember when you're on a plane and you're landing and you're seeing yourself from 10,000 feet above, little yous walking around, little boxes and little cars on the street, and said like, oh wait, that's me. And you're seeing yourself outside in, and it changes your perspective for a little, and hopefully it's always good to have perspective readjustments in life. You don't get caught in these very narrow assumptions. But Moshe uses the word boker. Strange word, boker, v'yod Hashem es ha-sholah. Boker? Machar, not boker. So, I don't know if I quoted the Medrash for you here, but yeah, I didn't quote the Pasuk. But basically, I'll just paraphrase or read the Medrash. Moshe is telling Korach, there's something called division. And division doesn't have to be unequal or immoral or exploitative or unfair. What is it a question of, it's fair, the morning gets more than the night, Bokeh gets more than Laila? It just means there has to be differences in this world. And if we weren't to have day and night, we'd go crazy. Night creates certain nocturnal experiences. Morning creates certain daytime experiences. We sleep, we replenish. Could you imagine if you go live in Alaska, and it's hard to live through 4 months of nighttime or 4 months of daytime. And there's a natural rhythm to the human experience that day and night serve. It doesn't make day better than night or night better than day. Does anyone have this sense here that day's better than night or that night got short, got shafted or day got shafted? It's just... In HaKadosh Baruch Hu's world, there has to be alternations, there has to be differences, there has to be distributions, there has to be, at least at the human level. We don't live the integrity of Hashem. Hashem is all one. There's no divisibility. Hashem is Yotzer or Varichos, Yechos, Hashem, V'yasakol. But human beings go through changes, live through experiences. You need to have a Beis HaMikdash that's not like your home. In your home, there's certain activities that are legitimate. Beis HaMikdash, other things that are legitimate. Have to be Kohanim, who help you through that segue. Levim, guard, leaders. We can't create homogeny. We can't efface differences. And how do you create a world that's both fair and egalitarian but still accounts for differences without it sounding bigoted? And that's what Moshe is telling Korach. I'm not better than you. Hashem has expectations of me. It doesn't give me privilege. We're not selected for privilege. When Hashem selected you, He didn't select you for luxury and privilege. He selected you for a challenge. You have to demonstrate to this world what it means to live a life of religious stricture, of mitzvahs, of Torah. And if Hashem had made you a Christian, that wouldn't have made you less. He would have then expected of you certain responsibilities and duties. And if Hashem made you a tree, again, you have consciousness, when He made you a tree, Hashem has certain wisdoms that we can't understand. He selects people, just like, why did Hashem make day and night? Why not call it something else and call it green and red and different types of variances and experiences? You can live a world in which people are each serving missions, but those are different missions, and they're equal, even though they don't look to you as equal, because you're grounded in a world of hierarchies and of presumed superiorities that just may not exist. I can promise you one thing, you're going to get to Shemayim, it's going to be a strange, strange, bizarre world, because people who got very, very little attention in this world are going to be extremely, extremely highlighted and showcased in the next world. Elyonim lamata, tachtonim lamala, tachtonim lamata. People who didn't garner a lot of attention, but live quiet, consistent lives of avodas Hashem, mitzvah performance, charitable, kindness, they're going to be pretty close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And all these go-getters who may or may not have lived lives in their private world that corresponded to their public faces may not be as positioned in Olam Haba as you would assume they were to be. And we don't know, and therefore we try to learn as much as we can from people as authentically as we can. But who is to know whether ultimately Korach will get more Olam Haba than Moshe Rabbeinu if he follows his trajectory, if he follows his mission, and Moshe follows his mission. And that's what Moshe is telling Korach. I'm not better than you, and I'm better than you. I'm not saying this, but essentially I'm better than you because I've been more loyal and I've been more dedicated and I've been more, but my station doesn't make me better than you. And that's what he said. Let's just read the Medrash together. Vayer vayivokar, bottom of source Gimel, vayavdel Elokim bein ha'or vein ha'choshech. Bishvil tashmisha shel olam, the top of the back page. Hashem had to create day and night in order for the world to function. Uchishay, Moshe is telling Korach, shehivdil bein ha'or uvein ha'choshech, bishvil tashmisha shel olam. Hashem created differences for the world to function properly. Kach hivdil Yisrael min ha'olos. All of a sudden, Moshe is talking about Jews and non-Jews because he's giving a background to the whole conversation. Korach wasn't saying he wants to be a goy. So why is Moshe telling him about Jews? Because he's giving him a treatise or a doctrine that there are differences, but the differences don't create supremacy. They just create differences and different responsibilities. And Korach's a great parsha to think about who you are as a Jew and not to feel bigoted and not to feel racist, but just to feel, I'm happy Hashem chose me. Hashem bacharbani mikol amim v'nasam lanu v'storosel, because in my world, I can't imagine not being selected, but if I hadn't been selected, I wouldn't have appreciated as much. And now that I'm selected, part of the selection is to be proud of my state. But if I never would have been selected for that, I would have chosen to perform my own state. I'm sure there are many, many billions of people who are living lives of value and fulfilling their mission as best they can, who have bliss and very happy with whom they are, and they don't have to be unhappy for me to be happy. My happiness is a function of knowing what my goal is and being proud to carry that goal. And they have recognition of a different goal and a different mission. It doesn't make them less happy or less important. And he says, V'chein hivdil Aharon, line number 3. So as part of that whole process, he creates division between day and night, and division between Jew and non-Jew, and within Jews, division between Aharon and other people. By Avdil Aharon HaKadisha, with Kodesh Kodashim. Im Yecholim Atem La'arev L'Savdala, you're going to start confusing Hashem's divisions and mix them up, Shehivdil Bein Aharon Vein HaKoshech, then you can cancel Aharon's selection. But no one in his right mind would want to cancel day and night. So why is this so abrasive to you? Why is this so jarring? It's a really important parsha to think about what selection means and to be able to articulate in a way that's not self-serving but that serves HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's built into nature and in no way is meant to, God forbid, Chalila Bachas, we're selective. It doesn't mean you treat people of different selection any less kindly and any less compassionately. And a lot of times people say when we show them talk that Jews have a higher metaphysical state than Goyim in ways that I think we don't often speak. But what about the Kuzari who talks about the Jew having an extra neshama? So I don't know. He's speaking in terms that I don't often think about or think in. But I promise you one thing. When Yehuda Levi would walk down the street, he'd be kind to the average Spaniard he'd cross in the street, the Gentile Spaniard. So at the end of the day, what difference does it make what you think in the world of theory? Whether you think that a Jew has a superiority or not, and what terms are used to describe that. As long as everyone has an equivalent experience. And when you pass the Jew in the street, you treat him kindly. When you pass the non-Jew in the street, you treat them kindly. So what you think in your head, only HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be able to determine both the terminology and the conclusion. I don't know what supremacy of soul means. I just don't know. I know who I am. I can't know who I'm not. I can't know realities that are beyond mine. But I know that Hashem gave me a potential and gave me expectations, and I'm going to try to serve those expectations, and I don't lord it over people as if that makes me superior. I'm proud that Hashem said. I know that it's a responsibility, and I try to carry that responsibility very, very carefully and very proudly. But I don't feel superior because of it in a way that at least expresses itself in ways that are disrespectful or in some ways disadvantageous to others. So three good ideas to think about for Parshas Korach. Number one, ambition, its opportunities, and its dangers. Number two, sarcasm and cynicism, as opposed to seeing things favorably and being enchanted, being awed. Number three, selection in a way that doesn't lead to bigoted or racist thinking. Okay? Stop here.